Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. This project I'm working on, God, I'm excited to share this with you guys, but I can't yet, but it's so cool. It gives me so much entertainment. I'm thoroughly entertained by this project, and I think you guys will be too. I think you will be too. No guarantees, of course. You might hate it, but I think you'll be thoroughly entertained, and I really want to share it with you guys. That's a top secret project. I think probably in about, a couple of weeks, it'll be ready to be shared with the class. All right, I just had a lot of pizza for dinner. I'm feeling very sleepy. Let's do the podcast. What are we talking about today? Stalling. Chapter 11, Part 1. Jean sounds cool. Let's talk about Cummings' attitude towards his imprisonment. Does he do much to ensure he'll get out as soon as possible? Does he seem to care about his fate? And does he curry favour with the right folk? I Am Norwegian said I really like this Jean character. He comes across as real despite how bizarrely he acts. Cummings' attitude. Cummings has only talked positively about his imprisonment so far. The same goes for B. I wonder what the father thought after suffering months of uncertainty and dread about his son, and writing impassioned letters in an attempt to find his son. And then Cummings Jr. makes a joke of it all. Yeah, good perspective. Probably quite a harrowing ordeal for the father. And then he encourages his son to write about it, and he does it as a sort of joke. But then again, maybe he got this attitude from his father. Could never take anything seriously or something like that. Like maybe his father belittled it. Like, it wasn't a real prison. I'm sure he didn't, but we don't know, do we? We don't know. I suppose those letters at the start would hint about it a little bit. Was there any humour in those letters? That's the question. There was kind of sarcasm, a bit of biting kind of sarcasm. Nifty Rufik said, Jean, posing as an English captain and parading around Paris, stealing the affections of ladies and beating up officers of supposed lower ranks with the full support of the law, was pretty funny. I skimmed through the correspondence at the beginning of the book to refresh it, to refresh, and it really just seems as though his eventual release was brought about by the efforts of others, including B, there with him. He fails to mention any effort of his own, and he just fails to mention many things while saying many, many things. He does. He says a lot, and he doesn't say much. Jean sounds cool, Tekrific said. He's the stereotypical happy African. He doesn't sweat the small stuff and tries to have a good time despite the circumstances. He draws the line at robbery, though, and rightfully so. It's the kind of thing that could trigger anyone into despair, violence, or madness. He tries to entertain himself and others, so he's cool in my book. Yeah, I think he's cool too. I would agree. He seemed good for entertainment's sake. absolutely. I like to say he's the stereotypical happy African. It reminded me of that bit in Get Him to the Greek where he says, I just hit the drum and make the Africa face. And he does that big smile. That's quite funny. As I said before, said Tekrific, I think he treats it like a safari or a country excursion. He's the observer type, so he seems to be having a jolly old time. Curry favour, I'd say no. He's been sarcastic and defiant, which I admire. He also seems to be conducive in avoiding PTSD or other confinement-related issues. I don't like him very much, but I say he's a survivor type, and he doesn't think he's in any real trouble. Whether that comes from privilege or just sheer ignorance, it's hard to say, but he seems to be doing well. I'm not so sure about some of his fellow prisoners who have been there longer, etc. Yeah, and I bet a lot of them are there under much more dire circumstances. Like, he was only really convicted as a friend of someone who had done something wrong. Like, they didn't even really have any proof that he'd done anything wrong. So he probably doesn't take it all that seriously. He thinks of anyone there, he's probably most likely to get out the easiest, right? That's what he's probably thinking. But in such an uncertain situation, wouldn't your mind would always think about the worst possible thing, like what if I died here, or what if I never get out, or what if I'm here for 50 years, and all the rest. So, yeah, it's a bit funny that he doesn't seem to feel any dread about his situation. Anyway, let's continue reading chapter 11. It goes like this. Oh, it's raining outside. It just started raining quite heavily. A little after the epic battle, that rain bit wasn't part of the book, by the way. That was just me commenting on my life. A little after the epic battle with Stovepipes between the young Pole and Bill the Hollander, the wrecked Powell, which was patiently waiting to be repaired, furnished Jean with perhaps his most brilliant inspiration. The final section of pipe which conducted the smoke through a hole in the wall to the outer air remained in place all by itself, projecting about 6 feet into the room at a height of 7 or 8 feet from the floor. Jean noticed this and got a chair mounted on it, and by applying alternately his ear and his mouth to the end of the pipe created for himself a telephone with the aid of which he carried a conversation with the wanderer, at that moment visiting his family on the floor below, to this effect. Jean, grasping the pipe and speaking angrily into it, being evidently nettled at the poor connection. "Hello, hello, hello, hello," surveying the pipe in consternation. "Merde kamachi pas," trying again with a deep frown. "Hello," tremendously agitated. "Hello," a beautiful smile supplanting the frown. "Hello, Babu. Are you there? Oui, bon." Evincing tremendous pleasure at having succeeded in establishing the connection satisfactorily. "Babu, are you listening to me? Oui. What's the matter, Babu? Comment. Moi. Oui. Moi. Jean. Jamais. Jamais, jamais, Babu. I've never said you have fleas. C'était pas moi. Tu sais. Jamais. C'était un auteur. Putreche c'était Mexique." Turning his head in Mexique's direction and roaring with laughter. "Hello, hello, Babu. Tu sais, Babu. Jamais dist ca. Au contraire, Babu. J'ai dit que vous avez des totos." Another roar of laughter. "What? It isn't true. Good, then. What have you got, Babu? Babu, lice? Oh, I understand. It's better." Shaking with laughter, then suddenly, tremendously serious. "Hello, hello, 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 hello." Addressing the stovepipe. "C'est une mauvaise machine, ca." Speaking into it with the greatest distinctness. "Hello, Babu. Liberty, Babu. Oui, comment. C'est la liberté pour... tout le monde corn. Après la soupe. Oui. Liberté pour tout le monde après la soupe." To which jest astonishingly reacted a certain old man known as the West Indian Negro, a stocky, credulous creature with whom Jean would have nothing to do and whose tales of Brooklyn were indeed outclassed by Jean's histories de mort, who leaped rheumatically from his palais at the word liberty, and rushed limpingly hither and thither, inquiring, was it true, to the enormous and excruciating amusement of the enormous room in general. After which Jean, exhausted with laughter, descended from the chair and lay down on his bed and to read a letter from Lulu, not knowing a syllable of it. A little later he came rushing up to my bed in the most terrific state of excitement, the whites of his eyes gleaming, his teeth bared, his kinky hair fairly standing on end, and he cried, "You, me, you, pas bon, you, me, bon, me, you, and went away capering and shouting with laughter, dancing with great grace and as great agility, and with an imaginary partner the entire length of the room. There was another game, a pure child's game, which Jean played. It was the name game. He amused himself for hours together by lying on his palais, tilting his head back, rolling up his eyes, and crying in a high, quavering voice, "Johnny," after a repetition of two of his own name in English. He would demand sharply, "Who is calling me? Mexico? Est-ce tu m'appelles Mexico?" And if Mexico happened to be asleep, Jean would rush over and cry in his ear, shaking him thoroughly, "Est-ce tu m'appelles tu?" Or it might be Babu, or Pete the Hollander, or B, or myself, of whom he sternly asked the question, which was always followed by quantities of laughter on Jean's part. He was never perfectly happy unless exercising his inexhaustible imagination. All of Jean's extraordinary selves, the moral one, of all of Jean's extraordinary selves, the moral one was at once the most rare and most unreasonable. In the matter of les femmes, he could hardly have been accused of by his bitterest enemy of being a Puritan. Yet the Puritan streak came out one day in a discussion which lasted for several hours. Jean As in the case of France, spoke in dogma. His contention was very simple. The woman who smokes is not a woman. He defended it hotly against the attacks of all the nations represented. In vain did Belgian and Hollander, Russian and Pole, Spaniard and Alsatian charge and countercharge. Jean remained unshaken. A woman could do anything but smoke. If she smoked, she ceased automatically to be a woman and became something unspeakable. As Jean was at this time sitting alternately on B's bed and mine, and as the alternations became increasingly frequent as the discussion waxed hotter, we were not sorry when the plantons shout, "A la promenade, la homme!" scattered the opposing warriors. Then up leaped Jean, who had almost come to blows innumerable times, and rushed, laughing, to the door, having already forgotten the whole thing. Now we come to the story of Jean's undoing, and may the gods which made Jean, La Nigra, give me grace to tell it as it was. The trouble started with Lulu. One afternoon, shortly after the telephoning, Jean was sick at heart and couldn't be induced either to leave his couch or to utter a word. Everyone guessed the reason. Lulu had left for another camp that morning. The planton told Jean to come down with the rest and get soup. No answer. Was Jean sick? Oui, me sick. And steadfastly he refused to eat till the disgusted planton gave it up and locked Jean in alone. When we ascended after la soupe, we found Jean as we had left him, stretched on his couch, big tears on his cheeks. I asked him if I could do anything for him. He shook his head. We offered him cigarettes. No, he did not wish to smoke. As B and I went away, we heard him moaning to himself, "Johnny no see Lulu no more." With the exception of ourselves, the inhabitants of the Lafferty Mature took Jean's desolation as a great joke. Shouts of "Lulu" rent the welkin on all sides. Jean stood it for an hour, then he leaped up furious and demanded, confronting the man whose lips the cry had last issued, "Finish Lulu." The latter coolly referred him to the man next to him. He in turn told to someone else, and round the room Jean stalked, seeking the offender, followed by louder and louder shouts of "Lulu" and "Johnny," the authors of which, so soon as he challenged them, denied with innocent faces their guilt and recommended that Jean look closer next time. At last Jean took to his couch in utter misery and disgust. The rest of Les Hommes descended as usual for the promenade. Not so Jean. He ate nothing for supper that evening. Not a sound issued from his bed. Next morning he awoke with a broad grin and to the salutations of "Lulu," replied laughingly heartily at himself, "Finish Lulu." Upon which the tormentors, finding him no longer the victim, desisted, and things resumed their normal course. If an occasional Lulu appraised itself, Jean merely laughed and repeated with a wave of his arm, "Finish." Finished Lulu seemed to be. But un jour I had remained upstairs during the promenade, both because I wanted to write and because the weather was worse than usual. Ordinarily, no matter how deep the mud in the core, Jean and I would trot back and forth, resting from time to time under the little shelter of the drizzle, out of the drizzle, talking of all things under the sun. I remember on one occasion we were the only ones to brave the rain and slow. Jean, in paper-thin soled slippers, which he had recently succeeded in drawing from the Gestionnaire, and I, in my huge sabots, hurrying back and forth with the rain pouring on us, and he very proud. On this day, however, I refused to challenge the challenge of the mud. The promenaders had been singularly noisy, I thought. Now they were mounting to the room, making a truly tremendous racket. No sooner were the doors opened than in rushed half a dozen frenzied friends who began telling me all at once about a terrific thing which my friend, the Noir, had just done. It seems that the trick raincoat had pulled at Jean's handkerchief, Lulu's gift in other days, which Jean wore always conspicuously in the outside breast pocket. That Jean had taken the raincoat's head in his two hands, held it steady, abased his own head, and rammed the helpless TR as a bull would do. The impact of Jean's head upon the other's nose causing that well-known feature to occupy a new position in the neighbourhood of the right ear. B corroborated this description, adding the raincoat's nose was broken and that everyone was down on Jean for fighting in an unsportsmanlike way. I found Jean still very angry and moreover very hurt because everyone was now shunning him. I told him that I personally was glad of what he'd done, but nothing would cheer him up. The TR now entered, very terrible to see, having been patched up by Monsieur Richards with copious plasters. His nose was not broken, he said thickly, but only bent. He hinted darkly of trouble in store for Lenoir, and received the commiserations of everyone present except Mexique, the Zulu, B, and me. The Zulu, I remember, pointed to his own nose, which was not unimportant, then to Jean, and made a moue of excruciating anguish, and winked audibly. Jean winked audibly. Jean's spirit was broken. The well-nigh unanimous verdict against him had convinced his minutely sensitive soul that it had done wrong. He lay quietly and would say nothing to anyone. Winked audibly. I like that. Because you know when people wink and they go like that? That noise? Sometime after the soup, about 8 o'clock, the fighting Sheeny and the trick raincoat suddenly set up Jean Le Nigre, apropos of nothing, and began pommeling him cruelly. The conscience-stricken pillar of beautiful muscle, who could have easily killed both his assailants at one blow, not only offered no reciprocatory violence, but refused even to defend himself. Unrestingly winced with pain, his arms mechanically raised up, his head bent, he was battered frightfully to the window by his bed, thence into the corner, upsetting the stool in the pissoir, thence along the wall to the door. As the punishment increased, he cried out like a child, "Laissez moi tranquille," again and again, and his voice, the insane element, gained rapidly. Finally, shrieking in agony, he rushed to the nearest window, and while the Sheenies together pommeled him, yelled for help to the planton beneath. The unparalleled consternation and applause produced by this one-sided battle had long since alarmed the authorities. I was still trying to break through the five-deep ring of spectators, among whom was the messenger boy, who advised me to desist and got a piece of advice in return, when with a tremendous crash open burst the door, and in stepped four plantons with drawn revolvers, looking frightened to death, followed by the surveillant who carried a sort of baton and was crying faintly, "Quest, at the first sound of the door, the two Sheenies had fled, and were now playing the part of innocent spectators. Jean alone occupied the stage. His lips were parted, his eyes were enormous, he was panting as if his heart would break. He still kept his arms raised, as if seeing everywhere before him fresh enemies. Blood spotted here and there that wonderful chocolate carpet of his skin, and his whole body glistened with sweat. His shirt was in ribbons over his beautiful muscles. Seven or eight persons at once began explaining the fight to the surveillant, who could make nothing out of their accounts, and therefore called aside a trusted older man in the order to get his versions. The two retired from the room, the plantons finding the expected wolf a lamb, flourished their revolvers about Jean and threatened him in the insignificant and vile language which plantons use to anyone whom they can bully. Jean kept repeating, "Laissez moi tranquille, vous l'entendez tout." His chest shook terribly with vast sobs. Now the surveillant returned and made a speech to the effect that he had received independently of each other the stories of four men, that by all accounts Le Nigre was absolutely to blame, and that Le Nigre caused an inexcusable trouble to the authorities and to his fellow prisoners by this wholly unjustified conflict, and that as punishment Le Nigre would now suffer the consequences of his guilt in the cabinet. Jean had dropped his arms to his sides. His face was twisted with anguish. He made a child's gesture, a pitiful, hopeless movement with his slender hands. Sobbing, he protested, "It isn't my fault, Monsieur le Surveillant. They attacked me. I didn't do a thing. They wanted to kill me. Ask him." He pointed to me desperately. Before I could utter a syllable, the surveillant raised his hand for silence. Le Nigre had done wrong. He should be placed in the cabinet. Like a flash, with a horrible tearing sob, Jean leaped from the surrounding plantons and rushed for the coat which lay on his bed, screaming, "Ah, mon couteau! Look out, or he'll get his knife and kill himself," someone yelled. And the four plantons seized Jean by both arms, and just as he made a grab for his jacket, thwarted in his hope and burning with the ignominy of his situation, Jean cast his enormous eyes up at the nearest pillar, crying hysterically, "Everybody is putting me in cabinet because I am black." In a second, by a single movement of his arm, he sent the four plantons reeling to a distance of 10 feet, leaped at the pillar, seized it in both hands like a Samson, and gazing for another second with a smile of absolute beatitude at his length, dashed his head against it. Once, twice, thrice he smote himself before the plantons seized him, and suddenly his whole strength wilted. He allowed himself to be overpowered by them and stood with bowed head, tears streaming from his eyes, while the smallest pointed a revolver at his heart. This was a little more than the surveillant had counted on. Now that Jean's mite was no more, the bearer of the crux de gueule stepped forward in a mild, placating voice and endeavoured to soothe the victim of his injustice. It was also slightly more than I could stand, and slamming aside the spectators, I shoved myself under his honour's nose. Do you know, I asked, whom you are dealing with in this man? A child. There are a lot of genes where I come from. You heard what he said. He is black. He is not. Or is he not? And gets no justice from you. You heard that. I saw the whole affair. He was attacked. He put up no resistance whatsoever. He was beaten by two cowards. He is no more to blame than I am. The surveillant was waving his wand and cooing, tu comprends, c'est malheureux. You're goddamn right, it's malheureux. I said, forgetting my French. Quand meme, he has resisted authority. The surveillant gently continued. Now, Jean, be quiet. You will be taken to the cabinet. You may as well go quietly and behave yourself like a good boy. At this, I am sure my eyes started out of my head. All I could think of was to say, attends un petit moment. To reach my own bed took but a second. In another second, I was back, bearing my great and sacred palais. I marched up to Jean. Jean, I remarked with a smile, you are going to the cabinot, but you are coming back right away. I know that you are perfectly right. Put that on. And I pushed him gently into my coat. Here are my cigarettes, Jean. You can smoke just as much as you like. I pulled out all I had, one full packet of Maryland and half a dozen loose ones, and deposited them carefully in the right-hand pocket of the pelisse. Then I patted him on the shoulder and gave him the immortal salutation, bonne chance, mon ami. He straightened proudly. He stalked like a king through the doorway. The astounded plantons and the embarrassed surveillant followed, the latter closing the doors behind him. I was left with a cloud of angry witnesses. An hour later, the doors opened. Jean entered quietly, and the door shut. As I lay on my bed, I could see him perfectly. He was almost naked. He laid on my pelisse on his mattress, then walked calmly up to the neighbouring bed and skillfully and unerringly extracted a brush from under it. Back to his own bed, he tiptoed, sat down on it, and began brushing my coat. He brushed it for a half hour, speaking to no one, spoken to by no one. Finally, he put the brush back, disposed the pelisse carefully on his arm, came to my bed, and as carefully laid it down. Then he took from his right hand outside pocket a full packet, jaune, and six loose cigarettes, showed them for my approval, and returned them to their place. Mercy, was his sole remark. B got Jean to sit down beside him on his bed, and we talked for a few minutes, avoiding the subject of the recent struggle. Then Jean went back to his own bed and lay down. It was not till later that we learned the climax, not till Le Petit Belge avec le bras casse, Le Petit Belge came hurrying to our end of the room and sat down with us. He was bursting with excitement, his well arm jerked, and his sick one stumped about, and he seemed incapable of speech. At length words came. Monsieur Jean, now that I think of it, I believe someone had told him that all male children in America are named Jean at their birth. I saw some sight, le nègre vous savez, he is strong, Monsieur Jean, he is a giant, crazy moi. C'est pour pas un homme tu sais je l'ai vu moi, and he indicated his eyes. We pricked up our ears. The balieur, stuffing a pipe nervously with his tiny thumb, said, you saw the fight here, so did I, the whole of it. Le noir avait raison. Well, when they took him downstairs, I slipped out too. Je suis le balieur, savez-vous, and the balieur can go where other people can't. I gave him a match, and he thanked me. He struck it on his trousers with a quick, pompous gesture, drew heavily on his squeaky pipe, and at last shot a minute puff of smoke into the air. Then another and another. Satisfied, he went on, his good hand grasping the pipe between his index fingers and his second fingers, and resting on one little knee, his legs crossed, his small body hunched forward. We, unshaven face close to mine, went on in the confidential tone of one who relates an unbelievable miracle to a couple of intimate friends. Monsieur Jean, I followed. They got him to the cabinet. The door stood open. At this moment, la femme descendiante, it was their corvée du, vous savez, he saw them, le noir. One of them cried from the stairs, is a Frenchman stronger than you, Jean? The plantons were standing around him. The surveillant was behind. He took the nearest planton and tossed him down the corridor so that he struck against the door at the end of it. He picked up two more, one in each arm, and threw them away. They fell on top of the first. The last tried to take hold of Jean, and so Jean took him by the neck. The balieur strangled himself for one benefit. And the planton knocked down the other three, who had got on their feet by this time. You should have seen the surveillant. He ran away and was saying, "Capture him, capture him." The plantons rushed at Jean, all four of them. He caught them as they came and threw them about. One knocked down the surveillant. The women cried, "Vive Jean," and clapped their hands. The surveillant called to the plantons to take Jean, but they wouldn't go near Jean. They said he was a black devil. The women kidded them. They were so sore, and they could do nothing. Jean was laughing. His shirt was almost off him. He asked the planton to come and take him, please. He asked the surveillant, too. The women had set down their pails and were dancing up and down and yelling. The director came down and sent them flying. The surveillant and his plantons were as helpless as if they had been children. Monsieur Jean Kilcuc chose. I gave him another match. Mercy, Monsieur Jean. He struck it, drew on his pipe, lowered it, and went on. They were helpless and men. I am little. I have only one arm, two says. I walked up to Jean and said, "Jean, you know me. I am your friend." He said, "Yes." I said to the plantons, "Give me that rope." They gave me the rope that they would have bound him with. He put out his wrists for me. I tied his hands behind his back. He was like a lamb. The plantons rushed up and tied his feet together. Then they tied his hands and feet together. They took the lacings out of his shoes, and for fear he would use them to strangle himself, they stood him up in an angle between two walls in the cabinot. They left him there for an hour. He was supposed to have been in there all night, but the surveillant knew that he would have died, for he was almost naked, and vous savez, Monsieur Jean, it was cold in there, and damp. A fully clothed man would have been dead in the morning, and he was naked, Monsieur Jean, un glint. This same petite belge had frequently protested to me that il est fun la noir. He is always playing when sensible men try to sleep. The last few hours, which had made of it the four a jaunt, made of the scoffer a worshipper. Nor did Le Bras Casse ever, from that time forth, desert his divinity. If as Belgier he could lay hands on the Monsieur de Payne or de Vinandi, he bore it as before to our beds. But Jean was always called over to partake of the forbidden pleasure. As for Jean, one would hardly have recognized him. It was as if the child had fled into the deeps of his soul, never to reappear. Day after day went by, and Jean, instead of courting excitement as before, cloistered himself in solitude, or at most sought the company of B and me and La Petite Belge for a quiet chat or a cigarette. The morning after the three fights, he did not appear in the corps for early promenade along with the rest of us, including the Sheenies. In vain did La Femme strain their necks and eyes to find the black man who was stronger than six Frenchmen, and B and I noticed our bed clothing airing upon the window sills. When we mounted, Jean was patting and straightening our blankets and looking for the first time in his life guilty of some enormous crime. Nothing, however, had disappeared. Jean said, "Me fix lits to les jours." And every morning he aired and made our beds for us, and we mounted to find him smoothing affectionately some final ruffle, obliterating with enormous solemnity some microscopic crease. We gave him cigarettes when he asked for them, which was almost never, and offered them when we knew he had none or when we saw he was borrowing from someone else, from his spirit held in less esteem. Of us he asked no favours. He liked us too well. When B went away, Jean was almost as desolate as I. About a fortnight later, when the grey, dirty snow slush hid the black, filthy world, which we saw from our windows, and when people lived in their ill-smelling beds, it came to pass that my particular amis, the Zulu Jean Maxiqueu, and I, and all the remaining miserables at La Ferté descended, at the decree of Caesar's Augustus, to enjoy our bi-weekly bath. I remember gazing stupidly at Jean's chocolate-coloured nakedness as it strode to the tub, rippling a texture of muscular miracle. Tout le monde had been, including the Zulu, who tried to escape at the last minute and was nabbed by the planton, whose business it was to count heads and see that none escaped the ordeal. And now tout le monde was shivering altogether in the anteroom, begging to be allowed to go upstairs and get into bed. When La Bagnore, Monsieur Richard's strenuous successor, that is, set up a hue and cry that one towel was lacking. The fencer was sent for. He entered, heard the case, and made a speech. If the guilty party would immediately return the stolen towel, he, the fencer, would guarantee that the party pardon. If not, Everyone present should be searched, and the man on whose person the serviette was found va attraper Quinn's jaw de Cabineau. This eloquence yielding no results, the fencer exhorted the culprit to act like a man and render the Caesar what is Caesar's. Nothing happened. Everyone was told to get in a single file and make it ready to pass out the door. One after one we were searched, but so general was the curiosity that as fast as they were inspected, the erstwhile bed enthusiasts, myself included, gathered on the sidelines to watch their fellows instead of availing themselves of the opportunity to go upstairs. One after one we came opposite the fencer, held up our arms, had our pockets run through and our clothing felt over from head to heel, and we were exonerated. When Caesar came to Jean, Caesar's eyes lighted, and Caesar, his though perfunctory proddings and pokings became inspired and methodical. Twice he went over Jean's entire body, while Jean, his arms raised in a bored gesture, his face completely expressionless, suffered loftily the examination of his person. A third time the desperate fencer tried, his hands starting at Jean's neck reached the calf of his leg and stopped. The hands rolled up Jean's right trouser leg to the knee. They rolled up the underwear on his leg, and there, placed perfectly flat up to the skin, appeared the missing serviette. As the fencer seized it, Jean laughed the utter laugh of old days, and the onlookers cackled uproariously, while, with a broad smile, the fencer proclaimed, "I thought I knew where I should find it," and he added, more pleased with himself than anyone had ever seen him, "Maintenant vous pouvez tous monter à la chamber." We mounted, happy to get back to bed, but none so happy as Jean Le Negre. It was not that the Cabineau threat had failed to materialize. At any minute, a planton might call Jean to his punishment. Indeed, this was what everyone expected. It was that the incident had absolutely removed the inhibition which, from the day when Jean Le Noir became Jean Le Giant, had held the child, which was Jean's soul and destiny, prisoner. From that instant till today, till the day I left him, he was the old Jean, joking, fibbing, laughing, and always playing Jean l'Enfant. And I think of Jean Le Negre, you are something to dream over, Jean, summer and winter, birds and darkness, you go walking in my head. You are a sudden and chocolate-coloured thing. In your hands you have a habit of holding 6 or 8 plantons, which you are about to throw away. And the flesh of your body is like the flesh of a very deep cigar, which I am still and always quietly smoking. Always and still I am inhaling the very fragrant and remarkable muscles, but I doubt if I ever am quite through with you. If if ever I will toss you out of my heart into the sawdust of forgetfulness. Kid boy, I'd like to tell you, la guerre est finie. Oh yes, Jean, I do not forget. I remember plenty. The snow's coming. The snow will throw, again, a very big and gentle shadow into the enormous room and into the eyes of you and me walking away and wonderfully up and down. Boy, kid, N-word with the strutting muscles, take me up into your mind once or twice before I die. You know why, just because the eyes of me and you will be full of dirt some day. Quickly take me up into the bright child of your mind before we go. Both go, suddenly all loose and silly. You know how it will feel. Take me up, carefully, as if it were a toy, and play carefully with me once or twice before I and you go, suddenly all limp and foolish. Once or twice before you go into great Jack, roses and ivory. Once or twice, boy, before we together go wonderfully down into the big dirt, laughing, bumped with the last darkness. All right. There we go, that's chapter 11. Looks like he's finished off the chapter by having another one of his weird strokes. whatever that all meant. Long chapter. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.